Everything you're about to hear is for education and entertainment purposes only. Whilst we are licensed, we're not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Any advice is general advice. Equity Mates operates under Australian Financial Services Licence 540697.
Australian investors love two things, miners and banks. Today we're looking at the top of the ASX as we see signs of change. From Equity Mates Media, this is Basis Points, a show that helps advisors find small improvements that compound into big outcomes. I'm Bryce, and with my co-host Ren, today we're speaking to William Curtain, Portfolio Manager of the Milford Australian Absolute Growth Fund and the Milford Dynamic Funds, about the opportunities at the top of the Australian share market, bank valuations, and whether the recent uptick in mining share prices is sustainable. A lot to cover to get through it, as always. Ren, how are you going?
I'm very good, Bryce. Banks, miners, and franking credits. Australian investors summed up in five words.
Very true.
We're not going to be covering franking credits today, but we are going to be covering the top of the ASX because it's been a really interesting dynamic we've seen over the past, 2 years, which is that Aussie miners have had a really tough run of things, while Australian banks, and particularly Commonwealth Bank, defy any investment banker's spreadsheets, defy security analysis by Benjamin Graham, and just keep going higher. The most expensive bank in the world, Australia has it.
Yes.
It's the big yellow one. And so we want to unpack what's going on there. And importantly, both for the banks and the miners, how long will these trends last?
Not only that, we're going to talk about the industrials and then some of the other sectors that William has his eye on to find opportunities outside of the top of the ASX. Now, we want to say a massive thank you to our launch partners of Basis Points, Milford, SIBO, and Orbis Investments. And Ren, today, a particular thank you goes to Milford.
That's right. Milford is Australia's boutique investment firm that works hard for your clients to capture the upside and minimize the downside.
Milford's active management investment philosophy means they keep a close eye on the markets and look beyond current trends.
They know that in volatile times, capital preservation is as important as delivering long-term risk-adjusted returns.
If you'd like to find more about what Milford have to offer and can do for your clients, check out milfordasset.com.au.
Before you invest, be sure to read the Milford Fund's product disclosure statement and target market determination at milfordasset.com.au.
And before we jump into it with William, a reminder that all of our content here at Basis Points is approved by the FAAA and available for CPD points. All you need to do is click the link in the show notes or the description below, and you can complete the quiz and get your certificate.
All right. Well, with that said, let's get to our conversation with William Curtain.
Well, Will, welcome to Basis Points.
Thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be here.
So we want to start by answering the question, are we seeing a change at the top of the ASX? Because the first 6 months of the year have been, you know, characterized by struggling resources sector and a strong rotation into banks. So can you tell us just how large this rotation was and what it was doing to valuations?
Yeah, no, there's certainly been a welcome reversal in the last month of the resources versus banks performance. So the bank leadership's really been going on for 2 years now, or the better part of 2 years. So 2 years to the end of June, where banks up 61%, including dividends, and resources to pull back 7% over that period, including dividends as well. So pretty poor returns, total returns. Last 6 months, banks have continued to outperform, up another 40, and resources have done pretty much nothing. Given that outperformance, a lot of the banks haven't grown earnings really over that period. There's been a little bit of earnings growth from CBA and a little bit of earnings growth overall, a lot of it through bad debt unwinds. But the returns have largely been P multiple expansion with a bit of dividends. So we've seen the bank sector PE all the way up in 9.5 times now. That was 13 and 14 times in more normal periods. CBA up to a whopping 28 times, the most expensive bank in the world, from 18 times a couple of years ago. And that 18 times, remember, was pretty pricey for a large bank. Resources sort of PE multiples haven't moved too much. They're up to 13 times from 11, but as we know, the earnings growth hasn't been there in that sector at all. So the question is, yeah, how long can this rotation outperformance of resources last? Because the last month we have finally seen BHP and Rio and broader resources get a bit of a bid, somewhat to a cost. from CBA in particular, which has pulled back 8 or 9% from the previous highs. So we can dig into that, I'm sure, over the coming questions if you want.
Yeah, well, but before we get into what we've seen in July, let's just hold on what we saw for the past 2 years, because CBA really was the poster child for everything going on and I guess confounded a lot of active managers. How did you understand what was happening with CBA? Was it a flight to safety? Was it just passive indexes buying the top of the market? Or was there something else driving such an extreme valuation for CBA?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, your question is how did we understand it, which I'll take as a different question to how do we understand it, because how we understand it today with the benefit of hindsight is probably more complete than how we looked at it 2 years ago. So we owned CBA going into this, but we sold out at about $114. So way too early. We were looking at more, hey, this thing's getting on 20 times earnings, a bit pricey. Earnings revisions won't be that big and sold out far too early. I'll unpack how we see it today. You know, how did this thing go all the way and so far? And, you know, how does it get up to damn near 30 times earnings, which is pretty pricey? So there's a bit to this, so bear with me. First of all, is it a safety trade? Well, there's a little bit of that. When people look at CBA and the Aussie banks in general, they may say, well, this company might not grow heaps, but I don't think everyone has very strong belief that in 10, 15, 20 years' time, these companies will remain robust businesses. So pretty good stores of wealth long run. The outlook for China's economy really slowed with the end of their property bull market. New home starts in China are down 75% from their peak a few years ago. The days of getting iron ore, spending periods in $140 US or $200 US are very, very likely to be over. So people sort of realizing that the best was over for iron ore and realizing that the super earnings of BHP and Rio weren't likely to come back again, decided to rotate out of resources and into other things, banks being a big beneficiary, the two big barbells of the ASX. Positive earnings revisions, particularly for CBA. A lot of this, CBA has a company that consensus sort of expected to not grow at all over the last couple of years, but unwind a few bad debts, net interest margins going down, but not as badly as Fed. And, you know, you grow at 3% per annum, not 0% per annum. And those positive earnings revisions tend to drive share price momentum more and more these days. Quantitative funds who chase earnings revisions or sell earnings misses and downgrades. And then, of course, one of the big factors, the rise of super and passive. So, you know, super funds in Australia continue to allocate about 25% of their inflows and their funds to listed ASX securities. So, you know, 25% of the dollar goes to the ASX 200. These days, CBA is over 10% of that index, so it's getting 2.5 cents of every dollar that goes into the super funds can go into CBA. So super funds own about 30% of the register of big banks. Passive will own another 25-odd%. For most banks, the retail household shareholding is about 32%, but for CBA, it's quite a bit higher, sort of into the high 40s%. So you back all that out and you make an assumption that the super and passive tend to be buying most of the time. And households tend to be reluctant sellers because they're sitting on big capital gains that they don't want to sell and have to pay a capital gains tax. So they will sell and they have sold, but it's a high threshold. You need to push the price high and higher to incentivize them to take some off. So, you know, what are you left with? There's sort of maybe as little as 10 or 15% of CBA owned by actual active managers. So who's setting your price? Who's the marginal price setter? Well, the passive and super buying is pretty inelastic. It's there to be bought. And then as you have a reducing pool of willing sellers by active managers, clearing price for CBA can just ratchet higher and higher. And that's what we've largely seen. One final factor just to finish this off is, remember, partly driven by CBA, but just in general, it's been a pretty tough few years for long-only Australian active managers. And that means that they're getting outflows. And CBA, until recently, has remained their largest underweight. Do you take $1 billion off an active manager and you put it into passive or in-house and super, which is fairly close to index makeup? Your biggest net bought stock is CBA. And then CBA outperforms more, the rest of the active managers underperform more. And more money goes back to passive. So it's a bit of a doom loop there.
Yeah, pretty crazy. We'll touch on, we'll unpack that in a little bit, but we want to turn to the miners because July's seen, as you said earlier in the piece, July's seen a slight change now with miners now having a strong month. Obviously, buoyed by the rising iron ore price and the like, with banks also starting to slightly fall off. So is this the start of a longer term change that we're seeing, or are we experiencing just like a shorter term sort of blip here?
We've obviously spent the last month or so looking at that exact question. We have a reasonable amount of iron ore miners. So our question was, is this going to carry for a year or do we fade this? We lean towards you fade this. That doesn't mean you have to sell it all right now and here, but you know, we thought this move could last 1 to 2 months and we're a month into that already. I think largely what set off this move and resources up and some of the momentum talks down is that just hedge funds globally running a lot of gross leverage. You're underweight things like resources, you're overweight some of the larger quality companies or technology companies. And then you find that all of a sudden the market starts getting a bit wild again. We've got meme stocks in the US going crazy, like in 2021, little events like the GameStop saga kicking off. You know, one person on Twitter pointed out that, you know, X insider, some company has 80% of its free float is shorted and the company goes up a couple hundred percent over the next week and that hedge fund, of course, is blowing up. So we've got this degrossing that's driving buying of losers, resources and other out-of-favour sectors as hedge funds sort of cover their shorts there. And then it's driving up some of these of those stocks with heavy short interest. So I think resources have benefited from that. At the same time, we've had a bit of positive sentiment towards China. One, China's finally moving ahead on this, call this involution, which is to reduce overcapacity in certain sectors like steel and cement and lithium and other sectors. And people have a view that'll drive up resources prices. And also we had the announcement of the large Tibet Dam, which is going to be many times larger than the Three Gorges. So we don't think those China-specific factors are actually that major or that good. The big dam will be built over 10 or 15 years, so it won't actually create much annual demand for steel. But also, if China cuts steel production capacity, they need less iron ore. So, you know, cutting production capacity of steel isn't positive. So, yep, we say this is a move to fade. It can go on another few weeks, but, you know, would be sellers into resources outperformance.
Nice one. Well, good point for everyone to think about, because I'm sure most people listening have some exposure to miners. I mean, if they're listening in Australia, it's almost national pastime to invest in miners. I'm sure it's the same over the ditch as well. But we want to, I guess, drill down on some of the points you made around the market structure. And in particular, you know, the world is seeing the rise of passive investing, but in Australia, we've got this additional kicker of the rise and continued rise of superannuation. So how do you think about the impact that super and passive flows are having on the system? And sort of as you're building portfolios and you're thinking about valuations, how much does the changing market structure factor into your thinking?
Oh, a huge amount. I mean, increasingly, it's just so important because for two reasons. One, can things get more insane? Things like CBA's valuation, the ASX maybe valuation. And then the second point, of course, is when will this come to an end? And when it comes to an end, if I'm still young enough to be in this industry and still working, then there's a huge opportunity to make money or at least protect capital, but also make money for our investors. So, you know, globally, it's a big theme, rise of passive. People talk about how expensive large cap stocks in America are. We have that occurring in Australia as well. We have a double whammy in Australia because it's not just the rise of super, it's the rise of, rise of passive. We also have the rise of super. Now, I just want to step back and look at it, run you through a few interesting stats. But over the last 15 years, the earnings growth per annum, so the annual earnings growth of the ASX 200 is only 1.3% per annum. Very little earnings growth over a 15-year period for our major index. You know, the earnings growth for other main markets, S&P 500, 8%, MSCI World, 5%. Canada's done 4.5%. Germany's done 7% per annum. UK's done 1.6%, so relatively poor like us. But despite this low earnings growth, you know, fortunately, we've still got a total return per annum over the last 15 years of 9%, which isn't too bad. That's not as good as what the US markets have done, but it's not too bad. You know, why is that? Because dividend yields in Australia were certainly better at the starting point. For a lot of the time, we had 5% dividend yields, but also the P multiple has gone up 61% in 15 years from 12 to 19 times. So had we not had that P multiple re-rating, then we certainly would not have anywhere near the good returns. So, you know, why is the ASX 200 on 19 times when an index like the FTSE 100 and the UK trades only on 13 times. I mean, they both have a similar mix of companies. The difference is 25 years ago, the UK pension system had 50% of its assets invested in UK equities. Today, it has only 5%. So the power of that index flows has meant the money's been going away, away, away from the UK, and their companies trade at low valuations. But Aussie, as you know, with rise of passive plus huge increase in superannuation assets invested into Australian equities, has meant that the ASX trades very expensively on a P multiple for the growth the index tends to offer, which for the ASX 200 earnings growth has been pretty minimal. How does this change the market and how we think? Well, we can't rule anything out. Can you rule out that CBA won't go to 35-time earnings? Absolutely not. You've got to be careful and look for that. Telstra is now on 22 times earnings after getting a bit of price momentum. Could that go to 30? Absolutely, it could. Absolutely. So you've just got to be aware of this. And that doesn't mean we have to completely change our investment approach. It doesn't mean we abandon fundamentals. But it means that you have an eye on the right tail outcomes in terms of how far can things go. So, yeah, interesting times.
So if super fund flow and sort of retail flow is a reason for, you know, people saying that the top of the market is distorted and it's the reason we're seeing CBA just continue to become more and more expensive and climb and climb, you know, we question how distorted the top of the market actually is when you sort of see meaningful volatility in some of the other big companies like BHP and the like. Like, shouldn't the same, I guess, principle apply to those companies as well?
Yeah. No, I think it would. So I'll touch on BHP quickly. BHP, if everyone all of a sudden for some reason thought that there was another structural boom in steel demand and iron ore demand coming, let's say India all of a sudden massively shows that it's really got its act together and it's booming like China did 20 years ago. That's not what I think is happening. But if it did, that would change a huge way that the market perceives, should I be owning BHP as a structural holding for the next 5-10 years? And you could see BHP go through the roofing because everyone's underweight iron ore and BHP. I mean, that company could rock it. Now, a more likely scenario at the moment is, you know, CSL, which has been missing earnings expectations for the last four or five years, really. It's now a 5% index weight, used to be 10. CBA's now a 12% index weight from 7 or 8. If CSL all of a sudden starts beating or missing, beating in earnings expectations, and starts to go up, then you could have CSL go back to very high P multiples. And that may drag money out of CBA as people rotate that way. Just a little bit of stats on there. So CSL's share price over the last 5 years is down 20%. And while CBA's share price over the last 5 years is up 127%. So this is largely late 2020 to today. One would think, okay, CSL's done poorly and CBA's share price has more than doubled. The earnings growth must have been way better at CBA than CSL. Well, not the case. So CBA's only grown its earnings at 3% per annum over those last 4 or 5 years. Why has PE multiple gone from 16 times to 27 times? Well, we unpacked a bit, but that 3% per annum earnings growth is probably a couple percent per annum better than everyone expected. So it's been beating earnings expectations. CSL has grown its earnings 8% per annum over that period, far better than CBA. But then why has CSL's PE multiple gone from 40 times to 21 times? Because everyone expected CSL to grow 11 or 12% per annum over the past 4 years, and it's only grown at 8, so it's missed. So that's just the power of the sentiment in this market. If you're missing earnings expectations, your PE multiple tends to go down, down, and down. There's no value investors or not enough value investors there to step in and look forward to drive the share price around. So you get a situation where CBA starts missing earnings and CSL beats. I mean, expect huge divergence in the performance of those two companies again.
So you've touched on a few sort of hypotheticals and how they could affect the outcomes for Australia's largest companies. As an active manager, it's your job to navigate these companies and these unknowns and generate returns for your clients. And, you know, as the market changes and the structure of it changes and big players sort of take up more space in the market, I guess, you know, sometimes history is a good guide. And I'm sure other times, you know, history is no longer instructive because the market is changing. So take us through your process, take us inside the investment committee at Milford and talk to us just about how you guys actually, you know, think about opportunities, find opportunities amongst this distortion and then sort of build portfolios around it.
Yeah, very good. We like to say occasionally as a team that, you know, there's a famous saying that four most famous words in finance at this time is different. And I think it's a very valid comment, but we like to say, you know, the five most dangerous words this time is not different. So you've got to be careful because history rhymes, but the timing of it, things can go on longer than you expect and things will change. The history won't exactly repeat. So this whole rise of passive and super and multiples and CBA is a good example. You know, for a start, we have some good, one thing is, you know, we don't really run traditional ASX 200 relative funds and that helps. So we're not, most managers are very benchmarked. Their entire goal was to beat the ASX 200. If you're underperforming it, you know, you've got to chase in and try and cover some of these underweights. They find it very hard to survive if you let the underperformance go on too long. Our main all-cap strategy in Australia, it's the Australian Absolute Growth Fund, that's got an RBA cash plus 5% benchmark, so we're absolute return. And that helps us not get drawn into some of the insanity that can sometimes push around the ASX 200. Yes, we're always going to be somewhat measured against ASX 200, but we've got a few tools and levers that most funds don't have. We can use a little bit of derivatives. So recently, we haven't owned a long CBA equity, but we've been buying CBA call options, and they were incredibly cheap. Going back over the last few months, we could buy a CBA call option with a strike a few percent above market, time to expire of 3 months of that call option. We only needed the share price to go up 6% to be break even and get our premium spent back. We're sitting there and saying this CBA share price tends to be up, up 25 or 30% over 3 months or down 10%. This is great risk reward, and they've done really well for us because all we need is CBA to go up more than 6%, or if it falls more than 6%, where you know our loss is capped to the premium spent. So that was a great way for us to make a bit of money in CBA. This momentum we're seeing help keep up a little bit with the market in recent times, but also not expose our investors to much risk.
Will, we're going to take a quick break, and on the other side, we're going to look beyond banks and miners and where you're finding opportunity elsewhere. We'll be right back.
A big thanks for today's episode goes to Milford.
Milford is Australia's boutique investment firm that works hard for your clients to capture the upside and to minimise the downside.
Milford's active management investment philosophy means they keep a close eye on the markets and look beyond current trends.
They know that in volatile times, capital preservation is as important as delivering long-term risk-adjusted returns.
Milford employees invest alongside you. They put their money in the same funds as your clients, so they are just as invested in the outcome as you are.
With a globally experienced team of 40 plus across both sides of the Tasman, they've earned a reputation for managing risk while delivering strong returns for investors over the long term.
If you'd like to find out more about what Milford can do for your clients, check out milfordasset.com.au.
Welcome back to Basis Points. We're here with Will, Portfolio Manager of the Milford Australian Absolute Growth Fund and the Milford Dynamic Funds. Now, Will, we've just spent time unpacking what's going on with banks and miners in Australia, but let's turn our attention to other parts of the market. If we did see a rotation away from the banks, where would the capital most likely flow, do you think? Do you think the next leadership leg comes from value? Is it growth or elsewhere?
We've touched on resources, and I've given you my view that we don't think there's a sustained bull market in the big resources, which is iron ore related. So, you know, commodity by commodity, but I don't think it's likely to be a sustained rally in resources. So that means the money would have to go somewhere else. So what are the ways that can happen? Maybe the money leaves the market entirely. Market drawdown and the money goes to cash, and you'd find that the banks and the large overvalued companies would have a pretty high beta in that kind of drawdown as money sucked out of them, or the money could go overseas. But you know, if it's going to go to another sector, we think healthcare and CSL is your prime, most likely candidate. You still require CSL to stop missing earnings and start beating and hitting them, which we think is coming soon. And otherwise, you can still squeeze more money into other industrials. You know, clearly Telstra's picked up a good following recently. It's doing well. It's got price momentum. So, you know, people are hiding in some of these names.
Well, let's hold on industrials, because there's been a few that have been delivering decent earnings growth and maybe are a bit overlooked by the market and some mainstream media. So where are you seeing some interesting stories in the industrial space and potentially any underappreciated value opportunities?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, industrials tend to be the key hunting zone for, by most sector managers. We've done plenty in gold and begun overweights there, but most managers sort of recently will be underweight resource, underweight banks. So you're trying to find these undervalued opportunities in industrials. And we still think that there's opportunities there. One really interesting one, which we're doing a lot of, done a lot of work on now, and we've got a position in, is Washington, Soul Patts, and Brickworks. So Brickworks is one of the larger companies in the ASX small caps. It's obviously a brick manufacturer, and Washington H Soul Patts is merging with it. So at the moment, Soul, the ticker SOL, is about 70th largest company in the ASX 100. It has no broker coverage, despite being a top 100 company. They're an investment business, but as these companies merge, then it will jump up to about the 35th largest company on the ASX. That means the index weight's going to increase a lot. That means, of course, what does that mean? It means passive's got to come in and buy a lot of it. It means active managers will try front run this and position ahead of it. On the back of this is there is going to be some sort of building construction boom pick up in Australia over the next few years, and Brickworks as a business has a lot of leverage to that. We could do very well. So we think it's a really interesting setup. You're going to have active managers who don't tend to own it, buying, passive buying coming. And then you're probably going to have some good earnings momentum from the building boom on Brickworks. So one to look at. It's going to be jumping up in the index. Otherwise, yeah, we like companies like ALQ, which are going to have a boom in earnings over the next few years. There's all the gold miners get out there and drill. Hey, gold at 5,000 Aussie or 3,500 US, let's drill and build up our resources. So they're going to have a great time. And we're structurally bullish on gold, still on a 5-7 year outlook. BlueScope, a little bit of negative earnings to come, but it's got great earnings revisions. It's got a great business strategically in Australia. Strategic steel manufacturing onshore in Australia, but also their North Star asset in the US is very good. And this company is really cheap versus where US steel companies play. So we think, if these company like that gets too cheap, we think ultimately it gets taken out or split up into its Aussie business or US business sold. So there's a lot of ways to extract value there. I've got plenty more I can go into. We've got some small caps ones if you want to go there later, but I'll leave the large cap ones at that.
It'd be good to just unpack your view on gold a bit more. It's always an asset class that gets a lot of attention in the basis points community. So what's the view long-term that you guys hold, and how are you, I guess, structuring the portfolio? Or what positions are you thinking about to take advantage?
We got 60 minutes more because I could probably go on a topic close to my heart. But, you know, as many of your listeners will know, and you'll know yourselves, for the last sort of 20, 25, 30 years, gold's really been an inverse play on interest rates, or more precisely, real interest rates. And people would love to show this correlation of inflation-adjusted US nominal bond yields and how gold will follow that. Gold will rally when real rates go down, and it'll fall when real rates go up. And the logic to that is the opportunity cost of holding gold is what you can get on inflation-adjusted risk-free rates. But you've got to be careful thinking that's always the case, because there'll be some tie to that. But what's happening now, and people are waking up to it, is there's one, a change in global geopolitics, and there's two, a sort of changing beginning in the global monetary order. So remember, one way or another, gold is effectively the reserve currency of the modern world for the last 300 or 400 years. You know, we go back far enough, and reserve currency is the British pound backed by gold, and then it was the US dollar backed by gold. You know, at periods of time, it was Spain or Portugal backed by gold. So the only time reserve currency has not been backed by gold is from the 1980s onwards, in the last 50 years, when the US removed the tie to the gold standards, and the US dollar has been a reserve currency on its own right. Now, one is the war with Russia and Ukraine, and seeing Russia's FX reserves in US dollars and euros effectively become worthless overnight is given the central banks around the world, particularly those that may not feel allied with the West, to, hey, we should increase our gold reserves. So China's buying huge amounts of gold for their reserves, and among others. And secondly, as many investors in the world, central banks and non-central bank investors are looking at the US fiscal deficits of 6.5%, the growing debt, and saying, I want an alternative, or at least some of my savings an alternative. So these are big structural issues. The tensions between the Western world, US-led, and Russia and China is unlikely to be resolved structurally. There'll be times where it backs off, but these guys are going to be aware of each other. And also the US seems to have no ability to rein in fiscal spending. So we think gold can continue to do very well over the next 5 years, until whatever fiscal deficit, devaluing of fiat currency inflation that the US is creating, until that's resolved, we think dips in gold are there to be bought without giving investment advice, but that's the way we're looking.
No. Well, no, everything here is general advice only. Will's not aware of your personal financial circumstances, but yeah, gold is certainly a fascinating topic in the equity mates and basis points community at the moment. And if you're saying the sell signal is when the US gets on top of its debt, well, then it might be a keep structural buying. Bull run for a lot longer.
That's right. And, you know, gold went up, I can't remember, 1,600% or something in the 1970s. I'm not saying we can go up 1,600% this time, but, you know, and then it collapsed in the 1980s when they got on top of inflation. After Volcker came in, they finally got on top of it. It collapsed. So, but you could have the same situation here. Gold goes up far more than anyone can conceive, and then one day the US or the global monetary order finds a new system, and it could collapse 70-80%. But I don't think we're there yet.
Up 1,600%, down 70 or 80%. You're starting to sound like you're talking about Bitcoin.
crypto is another topic, but they'll likely be fairly correlated. You know, crypto is probably a higher beta version of gold, but this, you know, it certainly plays into the hands of the crypto bros. This sort of
Well, look, let's stay in the equities world. You teased before that you had plenty of small caps, and we weren't going to avoid asking you about that. So before we get any particular names or where you're seeing opportunity, I guess if you think back to earlier in the conversation, we were talking about the distortion you're seeing in the top end of the market with the large caps and the inflows of super and passive. We imagine those effects would be smaller in the smaller end of the market. Are you seeing any distortions that we should be aware of as investors?
Well, these opportunities in smalls a bit, because this passive money and most of the super money is going into the large caps, and it's pushing up the valuations in large caps. That's not to say that small caps are necessarily cheap. The earnings growth hasn't been great in that space either, but it's got more opportunities, more hidden gems, more uncovered things, more things that we think aren't valued correctly, or things that are cheap, not as picked over. You know, good quality large cap companies tend to converge on this 30 times PE multiple with your Wesfarmers or Telstra's on its way there, or CBA, REA car sales will be better. But in small caps, we can find some companies that have got improving fundamentals, good earnings growth story emerging, and the multiples aren't too unattractive. So, passive's not coming into small caps. There's not really a significant FUM in small caps ETFs. So that creates opportunities for us as active managers.
Are there any that you particularly got your eye on at the moment?
Yeah, so, Brickworks, Soul Patch we've spoken to, but, you know, outside of that, Regis Healthcare, that finally we're in the phase in aged care. I mean, aged care, these industries tend to be poor investments long run, because society flips from, you guys are making too much money, I'm going to make your business models unviable and force you to make no capital returns, and they all collapse. Then they get a shortage of beds, and this is where we're at now. Australia is looking to be very short of aged care beds, and so they're improving the economics. They're making the industry more profitable. So we've got a 4 or 5 year plus, probably 7 year structural boom in aged care. Now, of course, Regis is pricing some of this in. Its share price has done very well, but you know, your earnings growth is going to continue to be strong for many years. So we still quite like Regis. In the biotech space, I'm getting really spicy here, and I'll go spicier again after biotech.
Nice.
But, we've owned Neuren Pharmaceutical for a long time, developed here in Auckland University. It's a drug that helps rare genetic disorders, tends to be in children. They have one commercial drug called Daybue in the US where they get royalties. But more importantly, they've got a pipeline of phase 3 trials coming up in about 18 months, 2 years time. These drugs are huge. If they get success there, this company's got multiple X upside. It is a biotech. You can never hand on heart say this drug's going to work, this one's going to pass trials. We've followed this company a long time. We're optimistic. We put, you know, a decent probability on it, but we think the risk reward's very good. But you've got to be patient, because it's a couple of years away from these big drug trial results. So it tends to happen as your share price 6 months out from the release of these big trial results will start to ramp. And, you know, we're following some of these little oil and gas plays in the Beetaloo Basin. In Northern Territory with interest. It's a shale play. They're starting to get better and better well results, some good flow results of gas. There's small ones called Beetaloo Energy and Tambaran Resources. We're not investors in them at the moment, but yeah, and if you ask what excites me, I would love to see these companies successful, because it'll create a huge industry for us. Getting something like the repeat of the coal seam gas boom earlier last decade. It's not just going to be opportunities in these small oil and gas companies, but the drilling companies, the labour, the benefits to Australian companies, lower gas prices in Australia eventually. So, you know, follow the drill results. It's exciting.
When you think about some of these oil and gas companies, how much do you think about like the political context? And in particular, I'm thinking about like the proposed, you know, reservation scheme and stuff at the last election. How much does that, I guess, political context factor into your thinking around the results that the companies are producing?
Yeah, rightly so, there's big political involvement in this sector because, like you say, we've got to restore rehab. It's really important. You want these companies to be improving their emissions and their impact on the environment to the degree we can. Politically, we're probably through the toughest period for this industry. The Labor government in, but they're pragmatic as well and seeing that, you know, the gas price and the cost of gas in Australia are a problem. Potential shortages, having to use coal more is not good for the environment. If we can bring on more affordable gas, then we don't have to use as much coal. That's better for our carbon emissions. So, well, it's never going to be a walk in the park in this industry. I think that's a more balanced approach. So good gas discoveries will have hoops to jump through, but I think the ultimate dispensation is a pretty mutually beneficial outcome and trying to get some decent gas projects back on. So, you know, Santos has just got there with their Barossa project. If the Northern Territory is hugely incentivised and supportive of the Beetaloo Basin, that would, you know, be great for their economy and also great for gas price in Australia if there was success there.
So, Will, we want to close with some questions around portfolio construction. And we started by speaking about the distorted benchmark, I guess, which is the ASX 200 with all of this passive inflows. And, you know, a lot of your peers then measure themselves against this benchmark that is, I guess, distorted. You don't. The Milford Australian Growth Fund benchmarks itself on RBA plus 5%. Is that part of the thinking why? Because of the distortions in the ASX, you wanted a different benchmark?
Yeah, it's more to do. I mean, Milford in New Zealand, before we started our businesses in Australia, we had huge success running absolute return focused funds. And so that was the genesis. Our original investors were actually private wealth advised clients. So we always had an absolute return approach for those investors. And then we had funds targeting absolute returns that have become very successful. I mean, the largest of those is $14 billion, nearly $14 billion in New Zealand now. There's another one that's $5 billion in size. So they're very, very successful. So when we came to Australia, we said, well, let's go out of the mold as well. There's no point doing ASX 200 long only products. We've got to do something different. We'll go absolute return again. That gives us a license to be more different to the market, a license to underperform the ASX 200 for longer. It doesn't give us the license to deliver bad absolute returns and bad returns versus the ASX 200 forever. So you've got to be pragmatic. We can't have an absolute return benchmark and then that's mainly focused on equities and underperform the ASX 200 by 6% per annum for 5 years and expect us to be doing a good job. But what it does is it buys us time. We don't have to sit there and chase 1 year to the next to close underperformance. We can use a bit of cash. We can use some derivatives to manage risk, put options, call options on stocks or index. We can do 10% international, and that gives us ability to not just manage drawdowns and capital risk, but also just smooth the returns overall while still getting good equity-like returns. One thing I'll mention is, you know, internally, Milford here in New Zealand, we actually have a product, a fund we run that's the ASX 100 equal-weighted benchmark. So it's a long-only Aussie equity product. But our New Zealand investors, or some of them funds, were saying, we want exposure to Aussie equities, but we don't need 10% in CBA and 7% in BHP. Yeah. Hey, you go run, build us a long-only book, large-cap focused, and given the benchmark's 100 stocks at 1%, you'll go and buy the best ones you want, regardless of their index weight. And that's what we've done. So that's an interesting product, also one that we could bring to the Australian market down the track if we think there's a demand for it.
Mm. So, Will, for advisors listening today, thinking about building portfolios with both a passive approach and active components for their clients, how do you suggest they think about managing sort of what's going on in the market, the market distortion, the market structures, and I guess take advantage of the opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, managing this sort of market, and I guess it's the same in all markets, is first of all, is understanding what does your client want and how is your client going to judge their returns. Maybe it's your boss or whoever else you may have to report to as well. But if your end investor is completely absolute return focused, they don't wake up and come in and say that ASX has gone up 15 and I'm only up 10 or or vice versa. But they just look at the 10% and say, awesome, I'm happy with that. And they come in the next year and they're down 5%, but the ASX 200 is down 30%, and they say, I had a bad year, I'm down 5%. Well, you know, that sort of advisor should really be looking at potential alternatives to passive ASX 200 and not allocating too much, because it's clear their investor isn't too worried about relative returns. So they could look at other active strategies that diverge from the ASX 200, more global equities or other markets that may be a little bit more reasonably priced in managing that. And of course, if your clients are going to track you against ASX 200, well, you might want to be a bit careful switching too much away from the ASX 200 passive sort of products and elsewhere, because you're going to be, you know, you can't rule out that the ASX 200 delivers nearly no earnings growth, but still does 10 or 12% per annum and multiples go to 30. So I don't think it can go forever, but we don't invest forever. We invest to our clients' end of lives or the end of your own career, or the, you know, when your clients need the money. So can it go on 10 more years? Of course it could.
So Will, to close it out, would love to just get your thinking on some of the things coming down the pike which maybe we're not thinking enough about, or maybe are being underestimated by the market. So as you look out ahead 6 to 12 months, what's a couple of the things that you're focused on that we may not be?
Golden opportunity to talk about AI here, but I won't actually, because I'll
I think the world is focused on that.
It's well covered. Interestingly, graduate unemployment in the US, or joblessness around university graduates, has got to 50%, and it's higher in kind of computer software and coding roles. So AI seems to be replacing, for the time being, a little bit of the demand for graduates and IT. But that's an interesting sign of weakness in the US. And you also have the private job number in the US are showing quite a bit of weakness. It's not reflected so much in the non-farm payrolls, which is done by the BIS. So it's done by the government, really, at agencies. So, you know, call me cynical, but weakness in the private numbers may be more of a reflection where jobs are going in the US at the moment. So what is the market not focusing on enough? We've had a good liquidity backdrop for the last little while because the US has been not issuing much debt, debt ceiling issues, getting its big, beautiful bill across the line. That means it draws down its savings at the Federal Reserve Bank and the Treasury government account. And it's akin to a mini QE. Money's coming out of circulation from the Federal Reserve, going into the economy, and it's supportive of liquidity, supportive of asset prices. Now, not to say that it's going to reverse, but as we get into August, the US government will start issuing more debt again, and that'll create a little bit of a drain and pull on liquidity. It may see T-bill prices get a bit disorderly eventually. At the same time, we'll probably have inflation prints continue to go higher in the US as the imported inflation starts to hit. And I think a softening of the US economy as some of the pull forward of demand ahead of tariffs, and you have an air pocket there. So you combine that with the liquidity draining, I think you just get a little bout of volatility at some point. I don't know if this one's going to be major. I'm not talking doom and gloom. We're going down 20, 30% again. But I think you can have a little hiccup at some point over the next couple of months. Watch out for that. Be ready for it. If you're a bull for the next 10 years, then as usual, buy those dips when they come. You've got to have money to buy dips. So wherever that comes from, whether it's your earnings, cash on the sidelines.
That's always the challenge, Will. That's always the challenge, having enough to take the opportunities as they come. But we thank you for joining us today. Certainly took a lot out of that episode, as I'm sure many advisors listening did as well. Plenty to think about when it comes to the top end of the market. But we really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me on. Great conversation.
Thanks, Will. Well, that does it for this episode of Basis Points. Make sure you're subscribed wherever you're watching or listening so you don't miss an episode. And if you're an advisor who wants to claim the CPD points, it's easy to do. Head to the podcast show notes or YouTube description, click the link, complete the quiz, and we will send you your certificate to claim your points.
You have been listening to an EquityMates Media production. In the spirit of reconciliation, EquityMates Media acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This podcast is intended for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general advice only and has not taken into account your personal financial circumstances, needs, or objectives. Before acting on general advice, you should consider if it is relevant to your needs and read the relevant product disclosure statement. And if you're unsure, please speak to a financial professional. The hosts of this podcast and their guests may have positions in the companies mentioned. EquityMates Media operates under an Australian Financial Services Licence 540697.